So those of you who have been here for the last year and a half of my tenure in this congregation may have figured out by now my usual preaching style. I start with an opening, it's a story, a quote, a news story. I build it up into a larger context. I link it to one or more of our seven principles. Then I lift up the power of the community to heal and restore, and then I send you out with a call for living into our mission and values outside of our sanctuary. Yes, I am that predictable, pretty much every time. Well, today I am starting at the end of the sermon. I caught that tiger by the tail on its way out, and I pulled it back in, and the end is at the beginning. Because I believe that we are at a crossroads in our human history, and I need you to hear this. If you take nothing else home with you today, please take this. You have within you, right now, just as you are, everything that you need to meet your muse, to engage with your genius, to raise your dead, to reclaim your creative life, your creativity, from where our culture told you to toss it in the gutter. You have within you the power to reconnect with that mysterious thing that calls to us from the earliest of our age, from before we even have memories, that force that led human beings to draw pictures on cave walls well before they developed agriculture. The need to create something, to live a creative life, poured out of us 30,000 years before it occurred to us that we could cultivate reliable sources of food. And creativity is not just about making a product. That is just something else to be sold. And once again, our culture tells us that that's the only way that creativity is valid, if its value is about money. The most important thing that you can create is yourself in relationship with the world around you. Our reading today, the excerpt from Big Magic, in which Elizabeth Gilbert tells us her thoughts on why it is so important to separate artistry and creativity from the concepts of suffering and torture. If you want to write something, you just open up a vein and bleed. If you want to write that great novel, you need to learn how to kill your darlings. The tortured artist. Valerie and I chose this work and this story, particularly of Susan the ice skater, because it focuses on something a person, Susan, does entirely for herself. It's not about winning medals. It's not about performing in shows. There is no audience. There is no sponsorships. There is no livelihood waiting at the end of each ice skating session. This person has resurrected something from their childhood that gave them joy, that allowed them to experience wonder and transcendence, that helped them live into their entire being. And recognizing that as an adult, raising that from the dead and putting it back in her life, helped her become a better person. It helped her become a better coworker, a better friend, and it made her better to others. But none of us, well, some of us maybe, I'm certainly not an ice skater. I'm really bad at it, actually. Not all of us are ice skaters, and this idea of living into yourself can take so many different forms and expressions. And figuring out what is ours can be a little scary and a little fun. Ruth Stone chases her poems around her garden, right? And as I pointed out, she still hasn't learned how to carry around a pen and paper. So maybe the chase is part of it for her. Susan ice skates 3 to 4 times a week before the sun comes up. I went back to school after 10 years of being out of it. I'd escaped, and then I had to go back to be a minister. President George W. Bush became a painter, and he's really good at it. Every day, somebody learns something new about themselves or rediscovers something they left behind. Every single day. The question is, do we keep it when we learn about it, when we feel it passing through us, even if we have to chase it down and catch it by the tail and pull it back in? Or do we let it slip through our fingers and keep on running down the road to the next person waiting in line? This brings me to our meditation and confronting those fears that tell us to let it go. Fear of failure, fear of ineptitude, fear of putting time and effort into something that doesn't bring us more stuff or bring us money to buy more stuff. Fear of mediocrity, as if being average is somehow bad. Well, if you were here for the services on New Year's Day, you know that I'm less than mediocre at running, really bad at it. But in doing it, I have found something that goes deeper in me than running to win. And if you were here on New Year's Day, you also heard me attempt to make up a song verse and sing it with no rehearsal, twice. I had to do it again for the second service, and to be fair and not cheat, I had to make up something entirely new. This was way out of my comfort zone. But we didn't plan that on purpose to embarrass me or anyone else who bravely came down without knowing what they were getting into to make up their own verses. We did it to lift up the creative life as something that can and often should be fun and delightful and messy. That by sharing our experiments with each other and our bravery, sharing our bravery in taking these risks when we do so, that there's really nothing to fear because we're doing it together. And our meditation today reminds us that stories to embolden and inspire us to live into this wonder and joy are not just coming from those around us in our community, but from our own past. We can look not just to what we may have tossed aside in our childhood, but also in our histories. Systems, especially family systems, carry long memories, even when the details are forgotten. And the homes, the families in which we grow up, either by birth or adoption, imprint their ghosts on us. Sometimes they are malevolent, yes. But just as often, they are benevolent. They are our permission slip to chase the fullness of our being and co-create ourselves with the multiverse, if we can just catch a hold when they run through us. And all this is just when we're working on ourselves on the one-on-one individual level. So I'm sure you all have heard the saying, charity begins at home, right? Is everybody familiar with that? It's often, ironically, thrown around as an argument to be less charitable, right? This idea that, well, you should take care of the stuff for you first before you start sharing with anybody else. In actuality, though, the origin of the term was about growth outward being a natural result and progression of tending to the needs inward. That by starting with generosity in the home, by being a loving, generous, kind person in your home, you would naturally become more generous outside the home because you were doing it every day and it was fully integrated into who you were all the time. So what I want to ask you today, what I want you to think about, is what would it feel like for you to be generous to yourself? What would it feel like to begin living into the affirmation of the inherent worth and dignity of every person by affirming that first about yourself? So much of the fear that we have around claiming a creative life is that we are taught to hate ourselves. And then we're taught to turn that self-hate out onto others who have less power than us. We witness it when the poor white worker who is made that way by the policies of the rich is convinced that their poverty is actually the fault of the black worker or the immigrant worker instead of the executive who maintains low wages and breaks up unions. We are taught it when we are told that if something we love to do won't pay us money that we can live on, that we need to find an alternative to do with our lives, and that we are a disappointment and a failure if we don't succeed in filling our bank accounts. We are told that sometimes a creative life is shameful. Charity, generosity begins at home. What happens if we recognize that because we are worthy of healthcare and love and support, that has to mean that everybody else around us is too? If creative expression is fundamental to our creation as humans from our beginnings in the cave, however you believe that creation to have come about, that also means that we should support learning how to embrace that fundamental creativity of the human condition, how to empower it and express it in our homes and in our schools and where we work. I'm very lucky I get to do that here with you. But it took me a really long time. But most of all, in communities like this congregation, places that exist to provide safe and loving and supportive environments for people to learn and grow, we have to support each other in being brave, in making really frightening, scary decisions, in running towards the thing that inspires us and is heading straight for us instead of watching it disappear because we're afraid to reach out and grab it. Fear is how we allow people to control and manipulate us. Fear is how we get convinced to back down when there's a fight that needs to be had, a fight that is often as much for our own sake as it is for the sake of others. And when fear becomes constant enough, when the anxiety is chronic, we become reactive. We become apathetic. We become so very tired. We dismiss it when people in power blatantly lie to our faces and we let them get away with it. We insulate ourselves and we intentionally try to avoid drawing attention to ourselves because that attention is dangerous. People will hurt us if they can see us. We become collaborators with our own slow destruction instead of collaborating with the creative life. And nowhere, nowhere was that creative life more apparent than in the marches across the world yesterday. So first service, we had like 5 candles lit. This service, we had 3 or 4. I know there's more of you out there. So if you were out on the streets yesterday, if you would be willing to raise your hand so we can see the creative life in action, please. Look at that. See, I'm preaching to the choir here. Thank you. <laughs> 20,000 people on the streets of Nashville. And this was not, clearly not, an exercise put forward by coastal elites. We're a landlocked state. Right? And this is the thing that isn't necessarily getting reported, so I want to make sure I talk to you about this today. It wasn't limited to big cities. Mentone, Alabama, with a total population of 360 people, total population, had 50 people come together for their women's march, okay? 50 people. That is 14% of the entire town population in Alabama, right? I mean, talk about going out and claiming a creative life and saying, this is worth something to me. We are not afraid of this anymore. The smaller cities and towns in the nation's heartland, the turnout was just as astonishing. And this is where the oppression is greatest. This is where the resistance and their witness is needed the most, and they showed up, and we showed up, and you showed up, and that wrote my sermon for me. Thank you. Not done yet, though. In some of the bigger cities, and you may have seen this, so many people showed up that the entire route was filled from the beginning to end, and nobody could actually do any marching. I mean, think about how many people that is. So instead of marching, they stayed in place, and they shared food, and they shared stories, and they played together, and they danced, and they broke out into song. And whether these gatherings had marching or not, they were undoubtedly an unstoppable outpouring of creative energy, just like those cave paintings on the wall from the infancy of our beginnings. They began from a single idea, tied to our country's history of resistance to tyranny and oppression, and our country's history that is inextricable from thousands of years of patriarchy that has made white women second-class citizens, and the racism that has debased women of color even more than that. The women's marches were not only the largest protest in our nation's history, they were a celebration of expression without fear. They were an expression of solidarity and community and of what it means to support each other in the diversity of our journeys into joy and wonder. They showed us what it looks and sounds and feels like to hold hands and stick together, like we're supposed to have been doing since kindergarten. And so I have come back around to where I began. The most important thing that you can create in this lifetime is yourself in relationship with the world around you. This is not a luxury. This is not an indulgence. It's not a waste. It is not an irresponsible choice. This is necessary and essential and vital for everyone's survival. Generosity begins at home with you loving yourself so that you may pour that love out onto others. Love yourself so that you can learn what the fullness of your being can be. Love yourself so that you are strong enough to learn from the wonder and joy of the diversity in our world and not run away from it. Love yourself so that you can trust yourself and chase your muse until you can grab it and hold it close and never let it go. May it be so.